So we're midway through the 13th chapter, The Lord of the Sacrifice. It appeared on Sri Aurobindo's birthday in 1917. And we are nearing Sri Aurobindo's 150th birthday. We got to the point that Sri Aurobindo in the essay has identified the Purushottama, the Supreme Person, as that being to whom the sacrifice is really given. That it is not a gift made out of the personal desire of the sadhak in seeking union with the Supreme, but to achieve the harmony of union with the divine. So he continues on that theme. In other words, man's way to liberation and perfection lies through an increasing impersonality. It is his ancient and constant experience that the more he opens himself to the impersonal and infinite, to that which is pure and high and one and common in all things and beings, the impersonal and infinite in nature, the impersonal and infinite in life, the impersonal and infinite in his own subjectivity, the less he is bound by his ego and by the circle of the finite, the more he feels a sense of largeness, peace, pure happiness. So this is an abiding experience that we find traced in Indian spiritual literature all the way back into the Veda, coming towards us through the Upanishads. And now Krishna figuring as Purushottama is giving articulation to this. Sri Aurobindo calls our attention again and makes no mention of his own experience. He rarely does mention himself singularly in the first person in the pages of the Arya. So this is, of course, the impersonal into which he first found release in 1908. And in that Brahmic extinction of his ego, he could continue to do work, he discovered. And that work was still more powerful. The people who heard him speak immediately upon his liberation, I don't mean his political liberation, I mean his spiritual liberation, remarked among themselves about the new power, the ease and felicitous expression in Sri Aurobindo's words as he gave speech after speech on the subject of the political liberation of India from the British. But the liberation was within for him first. He was no longer bound. He continued to do work. At that point, he did not have the idea of working for the Purushottama and no developing relationship of that sort. That came months and months later when he was in the Alipur jail, which he called a trysting ground, in which he could meet with delight with Krishna. An inner dance resulted. So, to widen into a oneness which includes all beings, which includes all beings physically, in the extensive cosmos that we see with our senses around us, but also with all life. That's a different plane of connectivity. And all subjectivity here, referring to the mind. So all these are planar insets, planar, insets within the cosmic hierarchy. All of these, the freed soul can range through without attachment, without egoistic identification. He continues, the pleasure, joy, satisfaction which the finite by itself can give, or the ego in its own right attain, is transitory, petty, and insecure. To dwell entirely in the ego sense and its finite conceptions, powers, satisfactions, is to find this world forever full of transience and suffering. Anityam asukam, chapter 9, shloka 33. The finite life is always troubled by a certain sense of vanity for this fundamental reason, that the finite is not the whole or the highest truth of life. Life is not entirely real until it opens into the sense of the infinite. So if we identify with the ego and find the world disappointing, beguiling, bedeviling, for one thing, it is because we are too small. We live in the little. We can't see the larger thing. And of course, that leads towards world rejection. And there are many philosophies which offer that, and spiritual paths too, which say this is the way out of it. Leave that unhappiness. Leave the impermanence of existence. And at the same time that the Upanishads were being composed, roughly then was when the great schools of rejection were being born, Buddhism and Jainism. The Gita is, in a sense, a corrective reply to those world-denying schemes of escape. The Gita will offer you spiritual freedom, but within the context of the world play. So let's go forward. It is for this reason that the Gita opens its gospel of works by insisting on the Brahmic consciousness, the impersonal life, that great object of the discipline of the ancient sages. For the impersonal, the infinite, the one in which all the impermanent, mutable, multiple activity of the world finds above itself its base of permanence, security, and peace, is the immobile self, the akshara, the Brahman. If we see this, we shall see that to raise one's consciousness and the poise of one's being out of limited personality into this infinite and impersonal Brahman is the first spiritual necessity. To see all beings in this one self is the knowledge which raises the soul out of egoistic ignorance and its works and results. To live in it is to acquire peace and firm spiritual foundation. So, step one. The way to bring about this great transformation follows a double path, for there is the way of knowledge and there is the way of works. And the Gita combines them in a firm synthesis. The way of knowledge is to turn the understanding, the intelligent will, away from its downward absorption in the workings of the mind and the senses, and upward to the self, the Purusha, or Brahman. It is to make it dwell always on the one idea of the one self, and not in the many branching conceptions of the mind and many streaming impulses of desire. So this is the way sketched out by the Sankhya yoga scheme. But in reality, such an absolute renunciation, passivity, and severance are impossible. Purusha and Prakriti are twin principles of being which cannot be severed. And so long as we remain in nature, our workings in nature must continue, even though they may take a different form, or rather a different sense, from those of the unenlightened soul. The real renunciation, for renunciation, sannyasa, there must be, is not the fleeing from works, but the slaying of ego and desire. Ahankara, kama, must go. The way is to abandon attachment to the fruit of works even while doing them. And the way is to recognize nature as the agent and leave her to do her works and to live in the soul as the witness and sustainer, watching and sustaining her, but not attached either to her actions or their fruits. So note here, the deep connection that Sri Aurobindo acknowledges between Purusha and Prakriti, not absolutely distinct, no, not separate, unmeeting realities. Purusha supports, sustains the action of Prakriti. But what we do to get released from ego and desire is to learn how to do the work without grabbing at the result, to turn it instead into a means of offering, and by offering, take the stress off the ego and the stress off of self-gratification, and instead make it more and more purely done as an act of nature working through us without our fussing about it, without our complicating it by trying to become boss of it. Let nature work. Be outside watching and supporting. So as he says again, not attached either to her actions or their fruits. So we begin to detach ourselves from that process that keeps us bound in the ignorance in this way. It is through the practice of karma yoga that we gain freedom, that we get into a state of knowledge. The ego, the limited and troubled personality, is then quieted and merged in the consciousness of the one impersonal self, while the works of nature continue to our vision to operate through all these becomings or existences who are now seen by us as living and acting and moving under her impulsion entirely in this one infinite being. The her is Prakriti, but in the larger context of the entire divine. Our own finite existence, Dikshara Purusha and all that belongs to it, our own finite existence is seen and felt to be only one of these, and its workings are seen and felt to be those of nature, not of our real self, which is the silent, impersonal unity. The ego claimed them as its own doings, and therefore we thought them ours. But the ego is now dead, and henceforth they are no longer ours, but nature's. We don't identify with them any longer. It's gone back to the province of Prakriti. We have achieved, by the slaying of ego, impersonality in our being and consciousness. We have achieved, by the renunciation of desire, impersonality in the works of our nature. So, essence and activity, both without ego interference. We are free not only in inaction, but in action. Our liberty does not depend on a physical and temperamental immobility and vacancy, nor do we fall from freedom directly we act. Even in a full current of natural action, the impersonal soul in us remains calm, still, and free. The liberation given by this perfect impersonality is real, is complete, is indispensable. But is it the last word, the end of the whole matter? All life, all world existence, we've said, is the sacrifice offered by nature to the Purusha, the one and secret soul in nature, in whom all her workings take place. But its real sense is obscured in us by ego, by desire, by our limited, active, multiple personality. Again, a metaphysical structure here. Inside Purusha sits nature, not otherwise. The one and secret soul in nature, all workings of Prakriti take place inside the soul, the Purusha. But we confuse it with our limited, restricted self. We have risen out of ego and desire and limited personality, and by impersonality, its great corrective, we have found the impersonal Godhead. So we've risen out of the Kshara Purusha, you remember that, yeah, the moving, mutable, changing personality, the one that dies, into the Akshara Purusha, the one who is eternal, without blemish, without fault. We have identified our being with the one self and soul in whom all exist. Ah, there's only one being. There's a conscious, eternal, infinite. We are all aspects, parts. If you want to see us as different from, we are Amsha, we are portions of it, but undivided from its whole. Not portions taken out and placed over here. We're always portions inside it. There is no outside, you see. The sacrifice of works continues, conducted not by ourselves any longer, but by nature. Nature operating through the finite part of our being, mind, senses, body, but in our infinite being. But to whom then is this sacrifice offered, and with what object? For the impersonal, Akshara, has no activity and no desires, no object to be gained, no dependence for anything on all this world of creatures. It exists for itself in its own self-delight, in its own immutable, eternal being. We may have to do works without desire as a means in order to reach this impersonal self-existence and self-delight, but that movement, once executed, the object of works is finished. The sacrifice is no longer needed. Works may even then continue because nature continues and her activities, but there is no longer any further object in these works. The sole reason for our continuing to act after liberation is purely negative. It is the compulsion of nature on our finite parts of mind and body, like a battery winding down. losing its energy, an engine spending the fuel in the tank. But if that be all, then, first, works may well be whittled down and reduced to a minimum, may be confined to what nature's compulsion absolutely will have from our bodies, and secondly, even if there is no reduction to a minimum, since action does not matter, and inaction also is no object, then the nature of works also does not matter. Aha! Arjuna, once having attained knowledge, may continue to fight out the battle of Kurukshetra, following his old Kshatriya nature, or he may leave it and live the life of the sannyasin, following his new quietistic impulse. Which of these things he does becomes quite indifferent, or rather, the second is the better way, since it will discourage more quickly the impulses of nature, which still have a hold on his mind, owing to past created tendency, and when his body is fallen from him, he will securely depart into the infinite and impersonal, with no necessity of returning again to the trouble and madness of life in this transient and sorrowful world. Anityam asukam imam lokam. 9:33. But this goes back to the old kind of liberation that Buddhism and Jainism were seeking. Detach from it, leave that ignorance, insert yourself into a poise of knowledge, compose yourself and rise into freedom. This will not do for Krishna, who is guiding Arjuna. If this were so, the Gita would lose all its meaning, for its first and central object would be defeated. But the Gita insists that the nature of the action does matter, and that there is a positive sanction for continuance in works. Not only that one quite negative and mechanical reason, the objectless compulsion of nature, there is still, after the ego has been conquered, a divine lord and enjoyer of the sacrifice, Bhoktaram Yajna Tapasam, and there is still an object in the sacrifice. This goes to chapter 5, shloka 29, and also chapter 12, shlokas 12 through 15. The impersonal Brahman is not the very last word, not the utterly highest secret of our being. For impersonal and personal, finite and infinite, turn out to be only two opposite, yet concomitant aspects of a divine being unlimited by these distinctions, who is both these things at once. God is an ever unmanifest infinite, ever self-impelled to manifest himself in the finite. He is the great impersonal person of whom all personalities are partial appearances. He is the divine who reveals in himself in the human being, the Lord seated in the heart of man. So chapter 13, shloka 17, shloka 18, and of course, chapter 18, shloka 61. Knowledge teaches us to see all beings in the one impersonal self, for so we are liberated from the separative ego sense, and then, through this delivering impersonality, to see them in this God, Atmani Ato Mayi, in the self, and then in me. That's chapter 4, 35. Our ego our limiting personalities, stand in the way of our recognizing the divine who is in all and in whom all have their being. For subject to personality, we see only such fragmentary aspects of him as the finite appearances of things suffer us to seize. We have to arrive at him not through our lower personality, but through the high, infinite, and impersonal part of our being. And that we find by becoming this self, one in all, in whose existence the whole world is comprised. This infinite, containing, not excluding all finite appearances. This impersonal, admitting, not rejecting all individualities and personalities. This immobile, sustaining, pervading, containing, not standing apart from all the movement of nature, is the clear mirror in which the divine will reveal his being. Therefore, it is to the impersonal that we have first to attain, through the cosmic deities, through the aspects of the finite alone. The perfect knowledge of God cannot be totally obtained. So this is 8:21, 11:18, and 11:37. But neither is the silent immobility of the impersonal self, conceived as shut into itself and divorced from all that it sustains, contains, and pervades, the whole all-revealing, all-satisfying truth of the divine. To see that, we have to look through its silence to the Purushottama. And he, in his divine greatness, possesses both the Akshara and the Kshara. He is seated in the immobility, but he manifests himself in the movement and in all the action of cosmic nature. To him, even after liberation, the sacrifice of works in nature continues to be offered. Illustrated in chapter 10, 15, and chapter 15, 18. So again, we arrive at the triple status of personhood. There is above, containing all, Purushottama. Purushottama extends itself in the immutable Brahman, and from that warehouse of sheer conscious being distributes itself into the manyness of this world that we see and contact with our senses, life energies, and mind. All of this here that we grapple with is a minor manifestation of the Supreme. As the Veda says, it has put forth one quarter of its being. The rest it holds behind. In between Purushottama and this mutable world that we deal with daily is that oceanic being of Brahman. That is the silence. That is the reality into which we have to gain our first release and freedom. But having attained that, then to get to the secret of the whole scheme, we have to rise to the status of the Purushottama, and through a purity and entirety of self-offering, arrive at an utter unity with the Supreme Person, which then blesses us with a beatific vision that embraces all. The individual, the universal, what is beyond the universe, and what is indescribably in that one. The real goal of the yoga is then a living and self-completing union with the divine Purushottama, and is not merely a self-extinguishing emergence in the impersonal being. Chapter 15, Shloka 19. To raise our whole existence to the divine being, to dwell in him, mayeva nivashishyasi, is to be at one with him, unify our consciousness with his, to make our fragmentary nature a reflection of his perfect nature, to be inspired in our thought and sense wholly by the divine knowledge, to be moved in will and action utterly and faultlessly by the divine will, to lose desire in his love and delight, is man's perfection. It is that which the Gita describes as the highest secret. It is the true goal. And the last sense of human living and the highest step in our progressive sacrifice of works. For he remains to the end, the master of works and the soul of sacrifice. So this is an adumbration of what is to come when we deal more directly with the Divine Personality. But the next chapter, the 14th, takes us into the principle of divine works, how it is that we achieve perfection in what we do and in what we offer. So, there's a section in Savitri in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge, which I think is relevant to what we've been reading tonight. It's on page 48 that it begins, near the top. Pardon me. In the oblivious field of mortal mind, revealed to the closed prophet eyes of trance, or in some deep internal solitude, witnessed by a strange immaterial sense, the signals of eternity appear. The truth mind could not know unveils its face. We hear what mortal ears have never heard. We feel what earthly sense has never felt. We love what common hearts repel and dread. Our minds hush to a bright omniscient. A voice calls from the chambers of the soul. We meet the ecstasy of the Godhead's touch in golden privacies of immortal fire. These signs are native to a larger self that lives within us by ourselves unseen. Only sometimes a holier influence comes. A tide of mightier surgings bears our lives, and a diviner presence moves the soul. Or through the earthly coverings, something breaks, a grace and beauty of spiritual light, the murmuring tongue of a celestial fire. Our self and a high stranger whom we feel, it is and acts unseen as if it were not. It follows the line of sempiternal birth, yet seems to perish with its mortal frame. Assured of the apocalypse to be, it reckons not the moments and the hours. Great, patient, calm, it sees the centuries pass, awaiting the slow miracle of our change. In this sure, deliberate process of world force and the long march of all revealing time. It is the origin and the master clue, a silence overhead, an inner voice, a living image seated in the heart, an unwalled wideness and a fathomless point, the truth of all these cryptic shows in space, the real towards which our strivings move, the secret, grandiose meaning of our lives. A treasure of honey in the combs of God, a splendor burning in a tenebrous cloak, it is our glory of the flame of God, our golden fountain of the world's delight, an immortality cowled in the cape of death, the shape of our unborn divinity. It guards for us our fate in depths within, where sleeps the eternal seed of transient things. Always we bear in us a magic key, concealed in life's hermetic envelope, a burning witness in the sanctuary, regards through time and the blind walls of form. A timeless light is in his hidden eyes. He sees the secret things no words can speak, and knows the goal of the unconscious world and the heart of the mystery of the journeying years. So, we shall end there. Thank you for your good company, your satsang. I send warm greetings from here, much love to all of you. Hope to see you again soon. Stay well. Namaste. Jai Ma.